Hello, this is the Love Letter Squad. I'm Teresa Ayers.
And I'm Janet Gallen, and we welcome you to another episode in the strength and resilience and spirit of human beings. We want you to remember that love letters are for anyone at any time for any reason, and that you put your best self on paper. When you write a love letter to somebody else, you are putting your best self on paper. You are sharing what you feel, and you are making somebody else's life richer if you write it and stamp it and mail it. So I want to go to our guest today, Andrew Lamb, who is the author of East Eats West and the editor, you say?
Yes.
Is that of the New American Media? So I just want to go to you after saying that I know that your transition from life in Vietnam to here has been a huge part of who you are,
sure.
I think, of how you define yourself even. You want to talk about just yourself and your life before and here and what went into becoming American?
Sure. Well, thank you for inviting me. I was born in Vietnam really during the middle of the war. And when I was 10, 11, the war ended and my family were forced to flee from Vietnam at the end of the war. And then we became refugees in Guam and then later on to Camp Pendleton.
And how long was that period?
That period was about maybe a month and a half.
Oh, so short.
It was
when
very
it comes
short.
To refugee life.
Yeah. Unlike others, we were lucky because we had an aunt who lived in San Francisco who sponsored us. And so we...
Well, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
When you say we were forced to flee, what made some families forced to flee?
Well, you know, the Vietnam War ended and the communists won.
Yeah, so it was political.
It was political, and my family belonged to the South.
Yes.
You know, the ruling class, regime, or whatever. Anything connected to the old world, the old government, people can be prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to leave, or my father would have been in jail and so on. So we lived in a very comfortable life in Vietnam, and then we became paupers in America, you know, ended up at the end of Mission Street, you know, Daly City. And, you know, three families in one two-bedroom apartment. And living off...
Was that very awful for you as a child, or was that just you were safe with your parents, so it was okay?
You know, it was a very strange time, because I didn't know really what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, one day I was in school in Saigon, and the next day I'm, you know, in a refugee camp, and then next day I'm in the U.S. trying to make sense of my new place.
How old were you then?
I was 11.
Okay. So, yeah, so you were definitely old enough to... feel the split between elegant living and pauper.
And, from riches to rags in that way. And, you know, but I, you know, being a kid, you're resilient. So basically, I embraced American life very quickly. I had a fantastic teacher, which I wrote about in the book, Mr. Kaisler, who really was generous and sympathetic and caring. And basically, within a year or two, I became an American brat, as my mom would call me. And
how did that happen?
You know,
what do you do culturally with yourself to go from one to the other?
You know, I think in some way, kids have to completely change themselves in order to embrace the new world.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, for a long, long time, I just pretended that my childhood didn't exist.
Really?
I just sort of pretended that Vietnam was a dream.
Were you aware of that at the time, or you're saying this now as a mature adult?
I was aware that I was pretending. I was playing a game,
yeah.
You know, because in Vietnam you wear a school uniform. In the U.S. you don't, and you know, in Vietnam you bow to your teacher. In America you look at everyone in the eye. You know, so behavior are different.
I see, yeah.
So, so I pretended that my whole past was a kind of fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the war. The horror, the chaos, and all that was just a fantasy. And just sort of embraced my American life. And I remember even within 2 years, I pretended that I was American-born. You know, so when someone said, where are you from? I said, oh, I was born here. You know?
Oh.
And that was my way of coping with the losses.
Yeah, sure.
And it took me about maybe 7-8 years before I came to terms with what happened. When I was in Berkeley, and then I started joining the Vietnamese Student Association.
Mm.
You know, had a lot of Vietnamese friends again.
And you didn't as a child? Were you isolated as a Vietnamese
child? Yeah, I mean, there were a couple other Vietnamese families that were related to us, and they moved to Daly City.
Oh, I didn't realize that you were without yeah, people so that you knew?
Uh-huh. We didn't really have, you know, Little Saigon really didn't exist in,
that's what I was wondering,
in the 70s. You know, Little Saigon sort of came to being probably mid-80s and so on. You know, and San Francisco, there's still very few Vietnamese compared to, say, Orange County or San Jose.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So for us in San Francisco, it was quite isolating. And in a way, it was good because I didn't rely on my own cultural you know, background, so I didn't really, you know, hold myself back.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Well, I recall that at that time, I think, that the phrase Vietnam referred to a war, not a country or a culture. Was that difficult?
Well, I mean, I think Vietnam was always...
For Americans.
For Americans, I mean, Vietnam was always some place of tragedy. So it's always a metaphor for our losses and our mistakes and so on. But it was very strange because Vietnam is a country for me.
Of course.
So, you know, it's really hard to reconcile with the American version of my homeland with what I knew of my homeland.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah. And in a way, that's one of the reasons why I became a writer.
I was going to ask you that, yes.
Because... So many people ask questions about it, and I say, no, you got it all wrong, you know?
You say something in your book, and I think in the first page, East Eats West, that I was so touched by it that I actually read it again and again. You said when you say the word for sour in Vietnamese.
Chua.
And you said that when you hear the word, that word, you have physical reactions, and your molars vibrate, and you salivate, and you can. And when you hear the word sour, you feel nothing.
Yeah.
I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah, I think it's primal. I mean, you know, your first 10 years is very important.
But even that explanation says so much about...
And but it's also a strange thing to be an American writer because, you know, the word sour, I understand, but the word dour, you know, has a visceral reaction in me. But that's just the way things work, and that's just the way for people who are born elsewhere who have to make their life in a new place. And I come to accept the differences within my own East and West.
But do you still feel connected very East right now that you're a grown man and that you've sort of recovered
I've come to
that?
Embrace the past. I mean, certainly part of the writing process is to acknowledge the losses. And, you know, since we're talking about love, the reason why I became a writer largely has to do with heartbreaks. Because when I was at Berkeley, I, you know, was a biochem major and I was pre-med, just like, you know, any good Asian boy, you know, with very demanding parents would, you know, become. But when I was in college, I also fell in love. And this love was profound and deep for me because it was with someone who shared the same cultural background. And so when we graduated, we broke up, but... It was inevitable because people were going different directions and jobs and so on, but it was still very painful.
Sure.
And so I took a creative writing class, thinking that I'm just going to talk about this love of mine.
Good. So putting your best self on paper and thinking about and bathing in both the difficult and the beautiful.
Sure. But was so interesting for me was that I came to. An understanding while trying to write about my love life was because it was so close and so raw and so fresh that I couldn't really render justice to it. But I also felt this heartbreak before and I didn't know why.
Oh.
And then I started realizing that this was not the first time I feel this heartbreak because, you know, when you share your love with someone, you share a private universe with someone and then that someone is gone. You feel like an exile.
Yes, of course.
And I've been an exile before. You know, that 11-year-old kid who stood in the refugee camp crying and, you know, thinking about what happened to his relatives and his home, his dogs and all that stuff. You know, like that whole world that he's familiar with and it's gone. And then I realized that, wow, you know, I didn't really mourn. I ran so far and so fast that I didn't really mourn what I lost, you know, and only when my heart broke from a personal romance that it opened itself up to the whole historical loss of a whole people.
Sure.
And then so I started writing, but not about my romantic life, but about what it's like to be an immigrant, what it's like to be a refugee, and what was it like to to lose a whole country and have to remake yourself.
A country that is your definition and a big part of your heart and who
yeah,
you are.
I mean, so. Yeah, I mean, you're just yeah. formed from that place, right. you know. And so I wrote a lot more. And then what happened was my creative writing teacher at UC Extension said, Andrew, you are not going to medical school.
Oh.
You are going to creative writing school, and I already called people at San Francisco State, and they want you. And that, my first answer was, my mom is going to kill me.
Yes.
Because I can't believe.
And him.
And, yeah.
And the teacher.
Yeah, and the teacher, yeah. But I just sort of, okay, if I got accepted, I should go because this is my calling now.
But then what did your parents say? What did your mother
say? My mom said, she cried and aww. She said, you know, I knew it, you know, sending you to Berkeley was a mistake because now they made you into a hippie.
Oh.
And I said, Mom, I'm going to creative writing program. I'm not dropping out, you know. But, you know, it was
Did she feel you would have been safer with a professional?
Oh, yeah.
Like
I mean, it's, I'm also first generation.
Yeah.
So who am I to pretend to have this fantasy of becoming a writer, you know? Especially.
But every culture has wonderful, important writers.
I understand. But for us, it was a very young community. It's, you know, when I applied to creative writing program at San Francisco State, it was 1990.
Mm-hmm.
So it was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that was very early for the Vietnamese community. It was only 15 years old. The majority were refugees, you know.
Yes.
So my dad said to me, who do you know is making a living writing in English?
Mm-hmm.
Name for me one, and you can name one, and I'll support you. And
did you come up with one?
No, because there were none, you know, and because it's a very young community.
This kind of writing.
Well, in any kind of writing, I didn't know anyone who was making a living writing at that point in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the community only existed for 15 years in the U.S. So I just say, well, I'm going to try to be the first.
Good for you.
And that's when they looked at me in a different way. And I was lucky, you know, because my parents were already making a living. They had a home already. So we had readjusted to American life. So it wasn't as if I needed to become a doctor to support my
mm-hmm.
family anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, and within a couple of years, I became a journalist. And I just sort of started, you know, traveling the world. And
what was your first journalism assignment?
It was very strange because I met, Richard Rodriguez, who's this wonderful writer, and he told me that, you know, I don't have to be writing fiction only. I can be literary journalists like, V.S. Naipaul, Joan Didion, and all these
sure.
people. And he introduced me to their writing, and then I just like, well, I love to, you know. So I wrote op-eds first, you know. Remember, my first op-ed for the San Francisco Chronicle was about the word stress. Because in Vietnam, we didn't have the word stress,
really?
Even though, you know, it's a very, tragic-filled country. But stress is a very American phenomenon, you know. So I wrote about that, and it ran in a Sunday paper, and then I wrote about what it's like to, you know, be a refugee in America and, you know, dream about Vietnam. It's very simple stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then I kind of graduated to become a reporter, and then I went to Hong Kong to report on refugees that were stuck there.
Oh.
And then I went back to Cambodia and Vietnam to report.
So your work became politically important kind of quickly.
Yeah, I was just lucky. I kind of hit the ground running.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of changed my parents' perspective on my whether or not I was a hippie or not, because I wasn't. I just became a writer.
So when I noticed in East Eats West,
yeah.
and something else that I had read of yours, you have remarkable way of grabbing motion.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound familiar to you? I mean, do you do that consciously? You've got motion down so well that there's no standing still.
Yeah, well, you know, I also do commentaries for NPR for 10 years, you know.
Oh.
And so, you know, they say, Andrew, you got 3.5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
You know, so how do you shrink a whole world of a narrative down to, you know, three and a half minutes?
I see.
So it's been good training for me in a way, you know.
Well, so is fleeing, I suppose.
Yeah, so is fleeing,
really.
Yeah.
And then having to adapt and
yeah.
having to redefine yourself, and it all has to do with not sitting still.
Yeah.
And then your very life of traveling and back and forth and reporting.
I mean, you know, it's funny because the first 11 years of my life in Vietnam, I was trained to love my homeland, to believe that, you know, this is where you're born and this is where you die.
And forever means something.
Yeah.
Huh?
And then suddenly we crossed the border and now my sense of home is so portable.
So now your sense of home really is San Francisco now,
isn't
it? It's
both San Francisco and the world, because in a way, San Francisco is a great jumping off point to everywhere else, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I live 3 blocks from BART.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can just grab my suitcase,
so again,
run
it's
to
motion.
BART.
Yes.
And then just, you know, end up at SFO and, you know,
anywhere in the world.
Go anywhere in the world.
Now, what is the New American Media?
It's a association of ethnic media around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do is we aggregate content from, you know, Chinese paper, Vietnamese paper, Hispanic papers, as a way to, you know, showcase different narratives in different communities.
And we find this online?
And you can find newamericanmedia.org.
Okay, so why don't you tell us what your relevant websites are so people can find you and your work?
You can go to redroom.com.
Spell it, please.
redroom.com.
Redroom.com.
Yeah, that's a website for writers.
Mm-hmm.
And then just enter Andrew Lam and you will find my
L-A-M,
website.
L-A-M. Yeah. Andrew Lam, yes.
Yeah. And the other one is
Is it New America or New America?
New America.
New America Media.
.org, yeah.
All in one.
Yeah, so I'm an editor of that website. So you can also find a lot of interesting articles on a lot of immigrant perspectives, for instance. So so that's what I do. I edit the website, I write, and I travel.
And your goal really is still, apparently, it sounds like from what you're saying and what you do, to bring the world together in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think because there's so many different worlds within me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People always say, oh, we live in a multicultural society, but people don't realize that people themselves, individuals,
yes,
have become diverse. You know, you inherit different aspects of yourself as you live, and different cultures are influencing you.
I thought you were going to say something differently. I thought you were going to say, even though it's a multicultural society, each individual is not so multicultural.
I think people are becoming more diverse than you think.
Interesting point.
You know, I mean, if you look at Berkeley,
They
say that 40% identify themselves as other rather than one race, because of children of mixed race are becoming the norm.
Yes.
Not only that, but even if you don't move, the borders shift in some way.
Yes.
And so, you know, I was eating dinner with a friend of mine, and he's from Germanic background, you know, and he used chopsticks.
Oh, I read you. Yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, it was... He gets really offended when the French tourists come and didn't know how to use chopstick in San Francisco. And for him, who's a San Franciscan now, basically, you're not a San Franciscan if you don't know how to use chopsticks.
That's right. And they sell chopsticks for babies, really, that are attached at the top so children can use them.
Yeah,
right.
And so it doesn't matter if you're white, black, or Asian.
Right.
If you live in San Francisco, you
don't
use chopsticks.
You know how to use chopsticks, of course.
So that diversity is not just about the other, but you have embraced that part of other people culture as well.
So you've redefined yourself as your borders around you have changed.
Yeah. And so I'm interested in how to reconcile between with all these new ideas. I mean, East West is kind of a play on words, obviously.
Sure,
You know, right now, if you look at what children are watching, it's all Japanese anime instead of Bugs Bunny or Tom and Jerry of old. And they are inheriting a completely different narrative than we know as we were growing up in
as it should be, really.
Yeah, and so, you know...
Standing still is not good.
Standing still is not good. And so, in a way, you're looking at the world in the U.S. that's been shifting very quickly because of cultural changes.
Well, if I were to ask you, I mean, I'm listening to you talk, and I've read some of what you've written, and listening to you talk, I could already write 2 love letters to people in your life. So, if you were to write a love letter right now, since that's what Teresa and I are about mostly, is taking what you feel and letting somebody else know, who would you write to?
Yeah.
What about the person you were in love with in Berkeley? Are you still in touch with that person?
In some way, yes. But, you know, it's been a long time.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what about, who would you, I mean, you've got parents, you've got that teacher who was so influential.
Yeah, he passed away.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, in a way, I did write a love letter to him. It was just in the L.A. Times yesterday, actually, in an op-ed. Basically, talking about going to his memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that was the letter that I wrote after he died because, you know, he was a very profound teacher who really treated me with generosity. And then he passed away, but I didn't know.
Oh.
And in some weird way, you know, he's not that far away from me, but I fled from the where Mission Street ended.
Yeah.
And live now where Mission Street began, which is downtown, you know, a shiny high-rise. And I always assumed that Mr. K will always be there.
Of course, we do assume that.
Yeah, but he's not. And, you know, and when his friend called me to speak at his memorial, I realized I should have kept in touch because, but, you know, I didn't. So.
Well, here's a really wonderful point that you're making.
Yeah.
And, you know, it gets to what Teresa always says, is say what you feel while you still have the chance.
Yeah.
And somehow, when you have something in writing, and in your own handwriting,
yeah.
Does he have family that you whose whereabouts you know?
Yeah, I actually send an article to his cousin, who is also his best friend in New York, and she said that I now have residence in her heart because you know, Mr. K died, and you know, he taught for 30 something years.
Did he have children?
No, he was a loner, and you know, basically. He came back to me all the time in memory because apparently I was a very good student. And and years ago, I wrote an article in which I talk about how I learned English.
Yeah.
And I, unbeknownst to me, he had kept it in the article.
Of course.
And then send it out to his friends. And in retirement, that was his validation.
Right. Okay. So you've just made. Thank you. I mean, you could just sit here instead of us.
Yeah,
because you just made a couple of points that I think are so interesting and so important in writing letters, and we call really any letter that has love in it a love letter,
yeah.
Not just for romance,
yeah.
Obviously. And you said he kept it forever, and it was his validation.
Yeah,
and that is the truth. That's what we say.
Yeah.
And when you sent that note, when you sent the article to his cousin, there was something in your handwriting, I would guess.
I emailed her, actually.
Okay, so... How about this?
Okay.
Just to think about, and if you feel like doing it, I think the power of it will be enormous on top of what you've done. Something in your handwriting.
Mm-hmm. I would send
signed
my,
by you.
Yeah, I would actually send my book to her. You know,
with a note?
With a note, yeah.
From
saying,
you. Okay. Just saying how much this person meant to you.
Yeah.
And whatever thoughts you have about his strengths and what he gave to you.
Yeah.
And... I mean, we vote for writing to people who are gone and saying, "Dear so and so, I'm writing this to you, but I'm going to send it to your cousin,
yeah,
or I'm going to send it to your children, or whatever it is. They'll have something historically and emotionally important for generations."
Yeah. So yeah, I definitely would send that.
Oh, good. Okay. Because handwriting is a powerful thing.
Sure. And unfortunately, we don't do that as much as we used to because
that's
of the
right. I think
high-tech world.
You wrote something about that.
I did write something about
that. Can you tell
that.
Us really quickly? Because I know you're on our side here.
Yeah. Well, it was an NPR commentary. But
yes,
basically,
I
talked about how one of my oldest friends from school said that even though we're more in contact more, we say less.
Yes.
Because when I was younger, when after I graduated from Berkeley, I used to write long handwriting letters to her. And then, of course, the electronic world took over. And then I just write to her like in sentences rather than graphs. And then she say, "Here, you know, you say, how are you? Saw a movie yesterday." You know, and that's it. Whereas, you know, she mailed me back an old letter
wonderful.
In which I talk about the rain and how the sound, it sounded on the
yes.
windowsill. And I thought, wow, how come I don't write like that to people anymore?
I hope you go home and do a couple. It'll be gold. And I'll tell you something that Teresa mentioned to me years ago, and it just somehow had never occurred to me. Technology changes.
Yeah.
You can't use your floppy disks, and you can't play your Betamax movies.
Yeah.
And whatever you have today is not going to be accessible.
Yeah.
Probably shortly.
Yeah, because technology keeps changing.
That's right. And so you think you can play that thing forever. Well, you won't be able to.
Yeah.
You know, we'll be riding a light beam to everywhere soon, I'm guessing. And the handwritten letters will last for close to forever, however long that is.
Yeah.
In somebody's treasure box.
But also, when we write it by hand, we think slower. Whereas when we type, we just like streamline everything.
Right.
You know,
you put more of yourself
into
what you do.
I mean, I go on Facebook all the time, and I realize what I write on Facebook is almost like in code. It's not a whole sentence.
And
you
is
know?
That cheating you in some way also?
Well, I mean, because technology is powerful, it allows you to connect to a lot more people
yes.
than one letter to one person at a time. So basically,
no, it's valuable for sure.
Yeah. And but there is the other side of it, which is that we don't write the complete sentence.
Mm-hmm.
We don't write prose in which we think deeply anymore.
That's right.
Because we don't have that kind
about
of
about either ourselves or the other person. You know, you give other person credit when you think deeply about and express deeply about.
Yeah, it's almost like an era of love letter writing. It seems to have passed.
It hasn't.
Okay.
It hasn't.
Well, Andrew, this is great. We have just a few minutes left. I want to hear a little bit more about your book.
East West.
So Janet has alluded to it a bit, but tell us in
my first book is called Perfume Dreams, and it's really about surviving the war and the meaning of having survived. You know, East Eats West is more like celebration of and thriving in America, and so I look at different cultural aspects of Asian immigrants and how that is changing the way we live in the United States. But they're all written through the personal essay form.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we mentioned anime, Japanese anime, and how it raises our children,
mm-hmm.
you know, and inform children with a different sensibility than, say, Bugs Bunny. I talk about kung fu movies and how that is changing the way Americans are making films.
Yes.
You know, I talk about cuisine, of course, you know.
Oh, yes, powerful.
If you go to farmers market, you know, 2 out of 3 of them at Civic Center are
mm-hmm.
Asians, you know.
Yes.
And because the immigrants don't just come, they bring seeds, they bring blends,
mm-hmm.
they bring beans and fruits. And that changes the way we cook in America.
Yes.
So
for the better.
And so the Asian influence in American cuisine is profound, you know.
Yes.
I mean, you look at the food networks, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, can see them, you know, being influenced.
And despite what people say, to the contrary, food is love. It's a way of, when you feed people you love, you want to keep them strong and alive.
And also continuation of the past, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at really different way of looking how Asian culture is changing the West.
Right.
Because when we talk about globalization, we tend to look one way, which is how KFC and McDonald's are proliferating everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's Thai restaurants and Vietnamese restaurants and Chinese restaurants, and no one thinks twice about ordering out for Chinese,
right.
you know.
Oh,
so the Easternization of America is as much part of globalization as the Westernization of the East.
So we can find this on Amazon? Can we also find it in bookstores?
Yes, you can find it on Amazon. You can find it in bookstore.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming to do this with us
and
talking about letters you've written.
Right. And thanks to all of our listeners. We hope you'll join us every week at this time. And in the meantime, we always encourage you to put your loving thoughts into words, stamp it, mail it, and send it while you still have the chance.
Absolutely. Thank you. This is Janet and
Teresa saying bye-bye for now.